Chapter 9.
Well now, what's our schedule? Tell us all about it, said Stepan Arkadyevitch.
Our plan is this. Now we're driving to Grozhva. In Grozhva there's a grouse marsh on this side, and beyond Grozhva come some magnificent snipe marshes where there are grouse too. It's hot now, and we'll get there, oh, it's 15 miles or so, toward evening, and have some evening shooting. We'll spend the night there, and go on tomorrow to the bigger marshes.
And is there nothing on the way?
Yes, but we'll reserve ourselves. Besides, it's hot.
There are two nice little places, but I doubt there being anything to shoot.
Levin would himself have liked to go into these little places, but they were near home. He could shoot there any time, and they were only little places. There would hardly be room for three to shoot. And so, with some insincerity, he said that he doubted there being anything to shoot. When they reached a little marsh, Levin would have driven by, but Stepan Arkadyevitch, with the experienced eye of a sportsman, at once detected reeds visible from the road.
"Shall we try that?" he said, pointing to the little marsh. "Levin, do, please, how delightful!" Vasyenka Veslovsky began begging,
and Levin had to consent. Before they had time to stop, the dogs had flown one before the other into the marsh.
"Crack! Laska!"
The dogs came back.
"There won't be room for three. I'll stay here," said Levin, hoping they would find nothing but pea-sweeps, which had been flushed by the dogs, and turning over in their flight, were plaintively wailing above the marsh. "No, come along, Levin, let's go together," Veslovsky called. "Really, there's not room."
"Laska, back! Laska!"
"You won't need another dog, will you?"
Levin remained with the brake and looked enviously at the sportsman. They walked right across the marsh. Except for a moorhen and pea-sweeps, one of which Vasyenka killed, there was nothing in the marsh.
"Come, you see now it was not that I grudged the marsh," said Levin, "only it's wasting time." "Oh, no, it was fun all the same. Did you see us?"
asked Vasyenka Veslovsky, clambering awkwardly into the brake with his gun and his pea-sweep in his hands.
"How splendidly I shot this bird, didn't I? Well, shall we soon be getting to the real place?"
The horses started off suddenly. Levin knocked his head against the barrel of someone's gun, and there was the report of a shot. The gun did actually go off first, but that wasn't how it seemed to Levin. What happened was that Vasyenka Veslovsky, while uncocking one trigger, had pulled the other. The charge flew into the ground without doing harm to anyone. Stepan Arkadyevitch shook his head and laughed reprovingly at Veslovsky. But Levin hadn't the heart to reprove him. In the first place, any reproach would have seemed to be called forth by the danger he had incurred and the bump that had come up on Levin's forehead. And besides, Veslovsky was at first so naively distressed, and then laughed so good-humouredly and infectiously at their general dismay, that one couldn't but laugh with him. When they reached the second marsh, which was fairly large and would inevitably take some time to go over, Levin tried to persuade them to pass it by, but Veslovsky again persuaded him. Again, as the marsh was narrow, Levin, like a good host, remained with the brake. Crack made straight for some clumps of sedge. Vasyenka Veslovsky was the first to run after the dog. Before Stepan Arkadyevitch had time to come up, a grouse flew out. Veslovsky missed it, and it flew into an unknown meadow. This grouse was left for Veslovsky to follow up. Crack found it again, and pointed, and Veslovsky shot it, and went back to the carriages.
"Now you go, and I'll stay with the horses," he said.
Levin had begun to feel the pangs of a sportsman's envy. He handed the reins to Veslovsky and walked into the marsh. Laska, who had been plaintively whining and fretting against the injustice of her treatment, flew straight ahead to a promising place that Levin knew well, and that Crack hadn't yet come upon.
"Why don't you stop her?" shouted Stepan Arkadyevitch. "She won't scare them," answered Levin, sympathizing with his bitch's pleasure and hurrying after her.
As she came nearer and nearer to the familiar breeding-places, there was more and more earnestness in Laska's exploration.
A little marsh-bird didn't divert her attention for more than an instant. She circled once in front of the hummocks, was beginning again, and suddenly quivered with excitement and became motionless. "Come, come, Stiva!" shouted Levin, feeling his heart beginning to beat more violently. And all of a sudden, as though some sort of shutter had been drawn back from his straining ears, all sounds, confused but loud, began to beat on his hearing, losing all sense of distance. He heard the steps of Stepan Arkadyevitch, mistaking them for the tramp of horses in the distance. He heard the brittle sound of the edge of a hummock on which he had trodden, taking this sound for the flying of a grouse. He heard, too, not far behind, a splashing in the water which he couldn't explain to himself. Picking his way, he moved up to the dog. "Fetch it!" Not a grouse, but a snipe flew up from beside the dog. Levin had lifted his gun, but at the very instant when he was taking aim, the sound of splashing grew louder, came closer, and was joined with the sound of Veslovsky's voice shouting something with strange loudness. Levin saw that he had his gun pointed behind the snipe, but still he fired. When he had made sure he had missed, Levin looked around and saw the horses and the brake not on the road, but in the marsh. Veslovsky, eager to see the shooting, had driven into the marsh and got the horses stuck in the mud. "Damn the fellow," Levin said to himself as he went back to the carriage that had sunk in the mire. "What did you drive in for?" he said to him dryly, and calling the coachman, he began pulling the horses out. Levin was vexed both at being hindered from shooting and at his horses getting stuck in the mud, and still more at the fact that neither Stepan Arkadyevitch nor Veslovsky helped him and the coachman unharness the horses and get them out, since neither of them had the slightest notion of harnessing. Without uttering a syllable in reply to Vasenka's protestations that it had been quite dry there, Levin worked in silence with the coachman at extricating the horses. But then, as he got warm at the work, and saw how assiduously Veslovsky was tugging at the brake by one of the mudguards, so that he finally broke it, Levin blamed himself for having, under the influence of yesterday's feelings, been too cold to Veslovsky, and tried to be particularly genial so as to smooth over his chilliness. When everything had been put right, and the carriage had been brought back to the road, Levin had the lunch served. "Bon appétit, bonne conscience. Ce poulet va tomber jusqu'au fond de mes bottes." Vasenka, who had recovered his spirits, quoted the French saying as he finished his second chicken. "Well, now our troubles are over. Now everything's going to go well. Only, to atone for my sins, I'm bound to sit on the box. That's so, eh? No, no, I'll be your automaton. You wait and see how I'll get you along," he answered, not letting go the rein when Levin begged him to let the coachman drive. "No, I must atone for my sins, and I'm very comfortable on the box." And he drove. Levin was a little afraid he would exhaust the horses, especially the chestnut, whom he didn't know how to hold in. But unconsciously he fell under the influence of his gaiety, and listened to the songs he sang all the way on the box, all the stories he told, and his imitation of driving in the English fashion, four in hand. And it was in the very best of spirits that after lunch they drove to the Grozhva marsh. Chapter 10. Vasenka drove the horses so fast that they reached the marsh too early, while it was still hot. As they drew near this real marsh, the chief aim of their expedition, Levin couldn't help considering how he could get rid of Vasenka and be free in his movements. Stepan Arkadyevitch evidently had the same desire, and Levin saw on his face the look of anxiety always present in a true sportsman when beginning a shoot, together with a certain good-humoured slyness characteristic of him. "How shall we go? It's a splendid marsh, I see, and there are hawks," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, pointing to two great birds hovering over the reeds. "Where there are hawks, there's sure to be game." "Now, gentlemen," said Levin, pulling up his boots and examining the caps of his gun with rather a gloomy expression, "do you see those reeds?" He pointed to an oasis of blackish green in the huge, half-mown, wet meadow that stretched along the right bank of the river. "The marsh begins here, straight in front of us. Do you see where it is the greener? From here it runs to the right, where the horses are. There are breeding places there, and grouse, and all around those reeds, as far as that alder, and right up to the mill. Over there," Do you see where the pools are? That's the best place. There I once shot 17 snipe. We'll separate with the dogs and go in different directions, and then meet over there at the mill. Well, who shall go to the left and who to the right? Asked Stepan Arkadyevitch. It's wider to the right. You two go that way, and I'll take the left, he said, with apparent indifference. Fine. We'll make the bigger bag. Yes, come along, come along, Vasenka exclaimed.
Levin could do nothing but agree, and they separated. As soon as they entered the marsh, the two dogs began hunting about together and made toward the green, slime-covered pool. Levin knew Laska's method, wary and indefinite. He knew the place, too, and expected a whole covey of snipe.
Veslovsky, beside me. Walk beside me, he said in a faint voice to his companion, splashing in the water behind him.
Levin couldn't help feeling an interest in the direction his gun was pointed after that casual shot near the Kolpensky marsh.
Oh, I won't get in your way. Don't trouble about me.
But Levin couldn't keep troubling, and recalling Kitty's words at parting,
mind you don't shoot one another.
The dogs came nearer and nearer, past each other, each pursuing its own scent. The expectation of snipe was so intense that to Levin the squishing sound of his own heel as he drew it up out of the mire seemed to be the call of a snipe, and he clutched and pressed the butt of his gun.
Bang! Bang! Sounded almost in his ear.
Vasenka had fired at a flock of ducks that was hovering over the marsh, and flying at that moment toward the sportsman, far out of range. Before Levin had time to look around, there was the whirr of one snipe, another, a third, and some eight more rose one after another. Stepan Arkadyevitch hit one at the very moment when it was beginning its zigzag movements, and the snipe fell in a heap into the mud. Oblonsky aimed deliberately at another, still flying low in the reeds, and together with the report of the shot, that snipe too fell, and it could be seen fluttering out where the sedge had been cut, its unhurt wing showing white beneath. Levin wasn't so lucky. He aimed at his first bird too low, and missed. He aimed at it again, just as it was rising, but at that instant another snipe flew up at his very feet, distracting him so that he missed again. While they were loading their guns, another snipe rose, and Veslovsky, who had had time to load again, sent two charges of small shot into the water. Stepan Arkadyevitch picked up his snipe, and with sparkling eyes looked at Levin.
Well now, let's separate, said Stepan Arkadyevitch,
and limping on his left foot, holding his gun in readiness and whistling to his dog, he walked off in one direction. Levin and Veslovsky walked in the other. It always happened with Levin that when his first shots were a failure, he got excited and out of temper, and shot badly the whole day. So it was that day. The snipe showed themselves in numbers. They kept flying up from just under the dogs, from under the sportsman's legs, and Levin might have retrieved his ill luck. But the more he shot, the more he felt disgraced in the eyes of Veslovsky, who kept popping away merrily and indiscriminately, killing nothing, and not in the slightest abashed by it. Levin, in feverish haste, couldn't restrain himself, got more and more out of temper, and ended by shooting almost without a hope of hitting. Laska, indeed, seemed to understand this. She began looking more languidly and gazed back at the sportsman, as it were, with perplexity or reproach in her eyes. Shots followed shots in rapid succession. The smoke of the powder hung about the sportsman, while in the great roomy net of the game bag there were only three light little snipe. And of these, one had been killed by Veslovsky alone, and one by both of them together. Meanwhile, from another side of the marsh came the sound of Stepan Arkadyevitch's shots, not frequent, but, as Levin imagined, well directed, for almost after each they heard, crack, crack, fetch. This excited Levin still more. The snipe were floating continually in the air over the reeds. Their whirring wings close to the earth, and their harsh cries high in the air, could be heard on all sides. The snipe that had risen first and flown up into the air settled again before the sportsman. Instead of two hawks, there were now dozens of them, hovering with shrill cries over the marsh. After walking through the larger half of the marsh, Levin and Veslovsky reached the place where the peasants' meadowland was divided into long strips reaching to the reeds, marked off in one place by the trampled grass, in another by a path mown through it. Half of these strips had already been mown. Though there wasn't so much hope of finding birds in the uncut part as the cut part, Levin had promised Stepan Arkadyevitch to meet him, and so he walked on with his companion through the cut and uncut patches.
"Hey, sportsman!" shouted one of a group of peasants sitting on an unharnessed cart. "Come and have some lunch with us. Have a drop."
Levin looked around.
"Come along, it's all right," shouted a merry-looking bearded peasant with a red face, showing his white teeth in a grin, and holding up a greenish bottle that flashed in the sunlight.
"Qu'est-ce qu'il dit?" asked Veslovsky.
"They invite you to have some vodka. Most likely they've been dividing the meadow into lots."
"I'd have some," said Levin, not without some guile, hoping Veslovsky would be tempted by the vodka and go away to them.
"Why do they offer it?" "Oh, they're merrymaking. Really, you should join them. You'd be interested." "Allons, c'est curieux."
"You go, you go. You'll find the way to the mill," cried Levin.
And looking around, he perceived with satisfaction that Veslovsky, bent and stumbling with weariness, holding his gun out at arm's length, was making his way out of the marsh toward the peasants.
"You come too," the peasant shouted to Levin. "Never fear. Taste our pie."
Levin felt a strong inclination to drink a little vodka and eat some bread. He was exhausted, and felt it a great effort to drag his staggering legs out of the mire, and for a minute he hesitated. But Laska was pointing, and immediately all his weariness vanished, and he walked lightly through the swamp toward the dog. A snipe flew up at his feet. He fired and killed it. Laska still pointed.
"Fetch it."
Another bird flew up close to the dog. Levin fired, but it was an unlucky day for him. He missed it, and when he went to look for the one he had shot, he couldn't find that either. He wandered all about the reeds, but Laska didn't believe he had shot it, and when he sent her to find it, she pretended to hunt for it, but didn't really. And in the absence of Vashenka, on whom Levin threw the blame for his failure, things went no better. There were plenty of snipe still, but Levin made one miss after another. The slanting rays of the sun were still hot. His clothes, soaked through with perspiration, stuck to his body. His left boot, full of water, weighed heavily on his leg and squeaked at every step. The sweat ran in drops down his powder-grimed face. His mouth was full of a bitter taste, his nose of the smell of powder and stagnant water. His ears were ringing with the incessant whir of the snipe. He couldn't touch the barrels of his gun, they were so hot. His heart beat with short, rapid throbs. His hands shook with excitement, and his weary legs stumbled and staggered over the hillocks and in the swamp. But still he walked on, and still he shot. At last, after a disgraceful miss, he flung his gun and hat on the ground.
"No, I must control myself," he said to himself.
Picking up his gun and hat, he called Laska and went out of the swamp. When he got to dry ground, he sat down, pulled off his boot and emptied it, then walked to the marsh, drank some stagnant-tasting water, moistened the heated barrels, and washed his face and hands. Feeling refreshed, he went back to the spot where a snipe had settled, firmly resolved to keep cool. He tried to be calm, but it was the same again. His finger pulled the trigger before he had taken good aim at the bird. It got worse and worse. He had only 5 birds in his game bag when he walked out of the marsh toward the alders where he was to rejoin Stepan Arkadyevitch. Before he caught sight of Stepan Arkadyevitch, he saw his dog. Crack darted out from behind the twisted root of an alder, black all over with the stinking mire of the marsh, and with the air of a conqueror sniffed at Laska. Behind Crack there came into view, in the shade of the alder tree, the stately figure of Stepan Arkadyevitch. He came to meet him, red and perspiring, with unbuttoned collar, still limping in the same way.
"Well, you have been popping away," he said, smiling good-humouredly.
"How have you got on?" queried Levin. But there was no need to ask, for he had already seen the full game bag.
Oh, pretty fair.
He had 14 birds.
A splendid marsh. I've no doubt Veslovsky got in your way. It's awkward, too, shooting with one dog, said Stepan Arkadyevitch to soften his triumph.
Chapter 11. When Levin and Stepan Arkadyevitch reached the peasant's hut where Levin always used to stay, Veslovsky was already there. He was sitting in the middle of the hut, clinging with both hands to the bench from which he was being pulled by a soldier, the brother of the peasant's wife, who was helping him off with his slimy boots. Veslovsky was laughing his infectious, good-humoured laugh.
"I've only just come. Ils ont été charmants. Just imagine, they gave me drink, fed me. Such bread, it was exquisite. Délicieux. And the vodka, I never tasted any better. And they wouldn't take a kopeck for anything. And they kept saying, excuse our homely ways.
What should they take anything for?
They were entertaining you, to be sure. Do you suppose they keep vodka for sale? Said the soldier, succeeding at last in pulling the soaked boot off the blackened stockings.
In spite of the dirtiness of the hut, which was all muddied by their boots, and the filthy dogs licking themselves clean, and the smell of marsh mud and powder that filled the room, and the absence of knives and forks, the party drank their tea and ate their supper with a relish known only to sportsmen. Washed and clean, they went into a hay barn swept ready for them, where the coachman had been making up beds for the gentlemen. Though it was dusk, not one of them wanted to go to sleep. After exchanging reminiscences and anecdotes of guns, of dogs, and of former shooting parties, the conversation focused on a topic that interested all of them. After Vasenka had several times over expressed his appreciation of this delightful sleeping place among the fragrant hay, this delightful broken cart, he supposed it to be broken because the shafts had been taken out, of the good nature of the peasants who had treated him to vodka, of the dogs who lay at the feet of their respective masters, Oblonsky began telling them of a delightful shooting party at Maltus's, where he had stayed the previous summer. Maltus was a well-known railway magnate. Stepan Arkadyevitch described what grouse moors this Maltus had brought into Tverskoye province, and how they were preserved, and of the carriages and dog-carts in which the shooting party had been driven, and the luncheon pavilion that had been rigged up at the marsh.
"I don't understand you," said Levin, sitting up in the hay. "How is it such people don't disgust you? I can understand a lunch with Chateau Lafitte is all very pleasant, but don't you dislike just that very sumptuousness? All these people, just like our liquor monopolists in the old days, get their money in a way that gains them the contempt of everyone. They don't care about this contempt, and then they use their dishonest gains to buy off the contempt they have deserved."
"Perfectly true," chimed in Vasenka Veslovsky.
"Perfectly.
Oblonsky, of course, goes out of bonhomie, but other people say, well, Oblonsky stays with them."
"Not at all." Levin could hear that Oblonsky was smiling as he spoke. "I simply don't consider him more dishonest than any other wealthy merchant or nobleman. They've all made their money alike, by their work and their intelligence."
"Oh? By what work? Do you call it work to get hold of a concession and speculate with it?"
"Of course it's work. Work in the sense that if it were not for him and others like him, there'd have been no railways."
"But that's not work, like the work of a peasant or a scholar."
"Granted. But it's work in the sense that his activity produces a result, the railways. But of course you think the railways useless."
"No, that's another question. I'm prepared to admit that they're useful. But all profit that is out of proportion to the labour expended is dishonest."
"But who's to divine what is proportionate?"
"Making profit by dishonest means, by trickery," said Levin, conscious that he couldn't draw a distinct line between honesty and dishonesty.
"But such as banking, for instance," he went on. "It's an evil, the amassing of huge fortunes without labour, just the same thing as with the liquor monopolies. It's only the form that's changed. Le roi est mort, vive le roi. No sooner were the liquor monopolies abolished than the railways came up, and banking companies. That, too, is profit without work."
"Yes, that may all be very clever and true. Lie down, crack," Stepan Arkadyevitch called to his dog, who was scratching and turning over the hay. He was obviously convinced of the correctness of his position, and so talked serenely and without haste.
But you haven't drawn the line between honest and dishonest work. That I receive a bigger salary than my chief clerk, though he knows more about the work than I do. That's dishonest, I suppose.
I can't say.
Well, but I can tell you. You're receiving some 5,000, let's say, for your work on the land, while our host, the peasant here, however hard he works, can never get more than 50 rubles, is just as dishonest as my earning more than my chief clerk, and Malthus getting more than a railway mechanic. No, quite the contrary. I see that society takes up a sort of antagonistic attitude to these people, which is utterly baseless. And I hold there's envy at the bottom of it.
No,
that's unfair, said Veslovsky. How could envy come in? There is something ugly about that sort of business.
You say, Levin went on, that it's unjust for me to receive 5,000 while the peasant has 50. That's true. It is unfair, and I feel it, but...
It really is. Why is it we spend our time riding, drinking, shooting, doing nothing, while they're forever at work? Said Vasenka Veslovsky,
obviously for the first time in his life, reflecting on the question, and consequently considering it with perfect sincerity.
Yes, you feel it. But you don't give him your property, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, intentionally, as it seemed, provoking Levin.
There had arisen of late something like a covert antagonism between the two brothers-in-law, as though, since they had married sisters, a kind of rivalry had sprung up between them as to which was ordering his life best. And now this hostility showed itself in the conversation as it began to take a personal note.
I don't give it away because no one demands that from me, and if I wanted to, I couldn't give it away, answered Levin. And I have no one to give it to. Give it to this peasant. He wouldn't refuse it.
Yes, but how am I to give it up? Am I to go to him and make a deed of conveyance?
I don't know. But if you're convinced that you have no right...
I'm not at all convinced. On the contrary, I feel I have no right to give it up, that I have duties both to the land and to my family. No, excuse me, but if you consider this inequality unjust, why is it you don't act accordingly?
Well, I do act negatively on that idea, so far as not trying to increase the difference of position existing between him and me. No, excuse me, that's a paradox.
Yes, there's something of a sophistry about that, Veslovsky agreed.
Ah, our host, so you're not asleep yet,
he said to the peasant who came into the barn, opening the creaking door.
How is it you're not asleep? No, how's one to sleep? I thought our gentlemen would be asleep, but I heard them chattering. I want to get a hook from here. She won't bite, he added, stepping cautiously around crack with his bare feet. And where are you going to sleep?
We're going to take the horses to graze tonight.
Ah, what a night, said Veslovsky, looking out through the huge frame of the open barn doors at a corner of the hut, and the unharnessed brake that could be seen in the faint light of the evening glow. But listen, there are women's voices singing, and not badly either. Who's that singing, my friend? The maid-servants close by. Let's go. Let's have a walk. We shan't go to sleep, you know. Oblonsky, come along. If one could only do both, lie here and go, answered Oblonsky, stretching. It's marvellous lying here. Well, I shall go by myself, said Veslovsky, getting up eagerly and putting on his shoes and stockings. Goodbye, gentlemen. If it's fun, I'll fetch you. You've treated me to some good sport, and I won't forget it. He really is a splendid fellow, isn't he? Said Stepan Arkadyevitch, when Veslovsky had gone out and the peasant had closed the door after him.
Yes, splendid, answered Levin, still thinking of the subject of their conversation just before. It seemed to him that he had clearly expressed his thoughts and feelings to the best of his capacity, and yet both his brother and Veslovsky, straightforward men and not fools, had said with one voice that he was comforting himself with sophistries. This disconcerted him.
It's just this, my dear boy. One must do one of two things. Either admit that the existing order of society is just, and then stick up for one's rights in it,
or acknowledge that you are enjoying unjust privileges, just as I do, and then enjoy them and get all the pleasures you can out of them. No, if it were unjust, you couldn't enjoy these advantages and be satisfied. At least I couldn't. The important thing for me is to feel that I'm not guilty. What do you say? Why not go after all? Said Stepan Arkadyevitch, evidently weary of the strain of thought. We won't go to sleep, you know. Come, let's go.
Levin didn't answer. What they had just said in the conversation about his having acted justly only in a negative sense absorbed his thoughts. Can it be that it's possible to be just only negatively? He was asking himself.
How strong the smell of the fresh hay is, though, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, getting up. There's not a chance of sleeping. Vasyanka is up to something there. Do you hear the laughing and his voice? Hadn't we better go? Come along.
No, I'm not coming, answered Levin.
Surely that's not a matter of principle, too, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling as he felt about in the dark for his cap. It's not a matter of principle, but why should I go? But do you know, you're preparing trouble for yourself, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, finding his cap and getting up. How so? Do you suppose I don't see the line you've taken up with your wife? I heard how it's a question of the greatest consequence whether or not you're to be away for a couple of days shooting. That's all very well as an idyllic episode, but for your whole life that won't do. A man must be independent. He has his masculine interests. A man has to be manly, said Oblonsky, opening the door. In what way? To go running after servant girls? Said Levin. Why not, if it amuses you?
Ça ne tire pas à conséquence.
It won't do my wife any harm, and it'll amuse me. The great thing is to respect the sanctity of the home. There should be no disturbance in the home. But don't tie your own hands.
Perhaps so, said Levin dryly, and he turned on his side. Tomorrow, early, I want to go shooting, and I won't wake anyone. I'll set off at daybreak.
Messieurs, venez vite!
They heard the voice of Veslovsky coming back.
Charmante!
I've made such a discovery!
Charmante!
A perfect Gretchen, and I've already made friends with her. Really exceedingly pretty, he declared in a tone of approval, as though she'd been made pretty entirely on his account, and he was expressing his satisfaction with the maker.
Levin pretended to be asleep, while Oblonsky, putting on his slippers and lighting a cigar, walked out of the barn, and soon their voices were lost. For a long while Levin couldn't get to sleep. He heard the horses munching hay, then he heard the peasant and his elder boy getting ready for the night and going off for the night watch with the beasts. Then he heard the soldier arranging his bed on the other side of the barn, with his nephew, the younger son of their peasant host. He heard the boy in his shrill little voice telling his uncle what he thought about the dogs, who seemed to him huge and terrible creatures, and asking what the dogs were going to hunt next day, and the soldier, in a husky, sleepy voice, telling him the sportsmen were going in the morning to the marsh and would shoot with their guns. And then, to check the boy's questions, he said,
"Go to sleep, Vaska. Go to sleep, or you'll catch it."
And soon he began snoring himself, and everything was still. He could hear only the snort of the horses and the guttural cry of a snipe. "Is it really only negative?" he repeated to himself.
"Well, what of it? It's not my fault."
And he began thinking about the next day.
"Tomorrow I'll go out early, and I'll make a point of keeping cool. There are lots of snipe, and there are grouse, too.
When I come back, there'll be a note from Kitty. Yes, Stiva may be right. I'm not manly with her. I'm tied to her apron strings. Well, it can't be helped. Negative again." Half asleep, he heard the laughter and mirthful talk of Veslovsky and Stepan Arkadyevitch. For an instant, he opened his eyes. The moon was up, and in the doorway, brightly lighted up by the moonlight, they were standing talking. Stepan Arkadyevitch was saying something of the freshness of one girl, comparing her to a freshly shelled nut.
and Veslovsky, with his infectious laugh, was repeating some words probably said to him by a peasant.
"Ah, you'd better get your own girl."
Levin, half asleep, said, "Gentlemen, tomorrow before daylight," and fell asleep. Chapter 12. Waking up at daybreak, Levin tried to wake his companions. Vasenka, lying on his stomach with one leg in a stocking thrust out, was sleeping so soundly that he could elicit no response. Oblonsky, half asleep, declined to get up so early. Even Laska, who was asleep curled up in the hay, got up unwinningly and lazily stretched out and straightened her hind legs one after the other. Getting on his boots and stockings, taking his gun, and carefully opening the creaking door of the barn, Levin went out into the road. The coachmen were sleeping in their carriages, the horses were dozing. One was lazily eating oats, dipping its nose into the manger. It was still grey out of doors.
"Why are you up so early, my dear?"
the old woman, their hostess, said, coming out of a hut and addressing him affectionately as an old friend.
"Going shooting, Granny. Do I go this way to the marsh?"
"Straight out at the back, by our threshing floor, my dear, and across hemp patches. There's a little footpath."
Stepping carefully with her sunburned bare feet, the old woman conducted Levin and moved back the fence for him by the threshing floor.
"Straight on, and you'll come to the marsh. Our lads drove the cattle there yesterday evening."
Laska ran forward eagerly along the little path. Levin followed her with a light, rapid step, continually looking at the sky. He hoped the sun wouldn't be up before he reached the marsh. But the sun didn't delay. The moon, which had been bright when he went out, by now shone only like a crescent of quicksilver. The morning star, which one couldn't help seeing before, now had to be sought to be discerned at all. What were before undefined vague blurs in the distant countryside could now be distinctly seen. They were sheaves of rye. The dew, not visible till the sun was up, wet Levin's legs and his shirt above his belt in the high-growing, fragrant hemp patch, from which the pollen had already fallen out. In the transparent stillness of morning, the smallest sounds were audible. A bee flew by Levin's ear with a whizzing sound of a bullet. He looked carefully, and saw a second, and a third. They were all flying from the beehives behind the hedge, and they disappeared over the hemp patch in the direction of the marsh. The path led straight to the marsh. The marsh could be recognized by the mist which rose from it, thicker in one place and thinner in another, so that the reeds and willow bushes swayed like islands in this mist. At the edge of the marsh and the road, peasant boys and men who had been herding for the night were lying, and in the dawn all were asleep under their coats. Not far from them were three hobbled horses. One of them clanked chain. Laska walked beside her master, pressing a little forward and looking around. Passing the sleeping peasants and reaching the first reeds, Levin examined his pistols and let off his dog. One of the horses, a sleek, dark-brown 3-year-old, seeing the dog, started away, switched its tail, and snorted. The other horses, too, were frightened, splashing through the water with their hobbled legs, and drawing their hoofs out of the thick mud with a sucking sound, they bounded out of the marsh. Laska stopped, looking ironically at the horses, and inquiringly at Levin. Levin patted Laska, and whistled as a sign that she might begin. Laska ran joyfully and anxiously through the bog, which swayed under her. Running into the marsh, among the familiar scents of roots, marsh plants, and slime, and the unfamiliar smell of horse dung, Laska detected at once a smell that pervaded the whole marsh, the scent of that strong-smelling bird that always excited her more than any other. Here and there among the moss and marsh plants this scent was very strong, but it was impossible to determine in which direction it grew stronger or fainter. To find the direction, she had to go further to the lee of the wind. Not feeling the motion of her legs, Laska bounded with a stiff gallop, so that at each bound she could stop short, to the right, away from the morning wind that blew from the east, and turned facing the wind. Sniffing in the air with dilated nostrils, she felt at once that not only their tracks, but also the birds themselves were here before her, and not one,
but many. Laska slackened her speed. They were here, but where precisely she couldn't yet determine. To find the very spot, she began to make a circle, when suddenly her master's voice drew her off. "Laska, here?" he asked, pointing her to a different direction. She stopped, asking him if she'd better not go on doing as she'd begun. But he repeated his command in an angry voice, pointing to a spot covered with water where there couldn't be anything. She obeyed him, pretending she was looking so as to please him, went around it, and went back to her former position, and was at once aware of the scent again. Now, when he was not hindering her, she knew what to do, and without looking at what was under her feet, and to her vexation stumbling over a high stump into the water, but righting herself with her strong, supple legs, she began making the circle that was to make all clear to her. The scent of them reached her, stronger and stronger, and more defined, and all at once it became perfectly clear to her that one of them was here, behind this tuft of reeds, 5 paces in front of her. She stopped, and her whole body was still and rigid. On her short legs she could see nothing in front of her, but by the scent she knew it was sitting not more than 5 paces off. She stood still, feeling more and more conscious of it, and enjoying it in anticipation. Her tail was stretched straight and tense, and wagging only at the extreme end. Her mouth was slightly open, her ears raised. One ear had been turned wrong side out as she ran up, and she breathed heavily but warily, and still more warily looked around, but more with her eyes than her head, to her master. He was coming along with the face she knew so well, though the eyes were always terrible to her. He stumbled over the stump as he came, and moved, as she thought, extraordinarily slowly. She thought he came slowly, but he was running. Noticing Laska's peculiar posture, she crouched on the ground as if dragging her hind legs along the ground and with her mouth half open, Levin knew she was pointing at grouse, and with an inward prayer for luck, especially with the first bird, he ran up to her. Coming quite close to her, he could from his height look beyond her, and he saw with his eyes what she was seeing with her nose. In a space between 2 little thickets, he could see a snipe. Turning its head, it was listening. Then, lightly preening and folding its wings, it disappeared around a corner with a clumsy wag of its tail. "Fetch it! Fetch it!" shouted Levin, giving Laska a shove from behind. "But I can't go," thought Laska. "Where am I to go? From here I feel them. But if I move forward, I shall know nothing of where they are or who they are." But then he shoved her with his knee, and in an excited whisper said, "Fetch it, Laska!" "Well, if that's what he wishes, I'll do it. But I can't answer for myself now," she thought, and darted forward as fast as her legs would carry her between the hummocks. She scented nothing now. She could only see and hear without understanding anything. 10 paces from her former place, a snipe rose with a guttural cry and the peculiar whirring of its wings, and immediately after the shot it splashed heavily with its white breast on the wet mire. Another bird didn't linger, but rose behind Levin without the dog. When Levin turned toward it, it was already some way off, but his shot caught it. Flying 20 paces further, it rose upward, and turning over and over like a ball, it dropped heavily on a dry place. "Now we're in business," thought Levin, packing the warm, fat snipe into his game bag. "Hey, Laska, will it be good?" When Levin, after loading his gun, moved on, the sun had fully risen, though invisible behind the clouds. The moon had lost all of its lustre, and was like a white cloud in the sky. Not a single star could be seen. The sedge, silvery with dew before, now shone like gold. The stagnant pools were all like amber. The blue of the grass had changed to yellow-green. The marsh-birds twittered and swarmed about the brook and upon the bushes that glittered with dew and cast long shadows. A hawk woke up and settled on a haycock, turning its head from side to side and looking discontentedly at the marsh. Crows were flying about the field, and a bare-legged boy was driving the horses to an old man who had got up from under his long coat and was combing his hair. The smoke from the gun
was white as milk over the green of the grass. One of the boys ran up to Levin.
"Uncle, there were ducks here yesterday,"
he shouted to him, and he walked a little way off behind him. And Levin was doubly pleased, in sight of the boy, who expressed his approval at killing three snipe one after another. Chapter 13. The huntsman's saying that if the first beast or the first bird is not missed, the day will be lucky, turned out to be true. At 10 o'clock, Levin, weary, hungry, and happy after tramping 20 miles, returned to his night's lodging with 19 head of fine game and 1 duck, which he tied to his belt as it wouldn't go into the game bag. His companions had long been awake and had had time to get hungry and have breakfast.
"Wait a while, wait a while. I know there are 19, said Levin, counting again the snipe and double snipe that looked so much less handsome now, bent and dry and blood-stained, with heads crooked aside, than they did when they were flying. The number was verified, and Stepan Arkadyevitch's envy pleased Levin. He was pleased, too, on returning, to find that the man Kitty sent with a note was already there.
"I'm perfectly well and happy. If you were uneasy about me, you can feel easier than ever. I've a new bodyguard, Maria Vlasyevna."
This was the midwife, a new and important person in Levin's domestic life.
"She's come to have a look at me. She found me perfectly well, and we've kept her till you are back. All are happy and well, and please, don't be in a hurry to come back, but if the sport is good, stay another day."
These two pleasures, his lucky shooting and the letter from his wife, were so great that two slightly disagreeable incidents passed lightly over Levin. One was that the chestnut trace horse was off his feed and out of sorts. The coachman said,
"He was overdriven yesterday, Konstantin Dmitrievich."
"Yes, absolutely. 7 miles like that, without sense."
The other unpleasant incident, which for the first minute destroyed his good humour, though later he laughed at it a great deal, was to find that of all the provisions Kitty had provided in such abundance that one would have thought there was enough for a week, nothing was left. On his way back, tired and hungry from shooting, Levin had so distinct a vision of meat pies that as he approached the hut he seemed to smell and taste them, as Laska had smelled the game, and he immediately told Philippe to give him some. It appeared that there were no pies left, nor even any chicken.
"Well, this fellow's appetite," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, laughing and pointing at Vasyenka Veslovsky. "I never suffer from loss of appetite, but he's really marvellous."
"Well, it can't be helped," said Levin, looking gloomily at Veslovsky.
"Well, Philippe, give me some beef, then." "The beef's been eaten and the bones given to the dogs," answered Philippe.
Levin was so hurt that he said in a tone of vexation, "You might have left me something," and he felt ready to cry.
"Then put away the game," he said in a shaking voice to Philippe, trying not to look at Vasyenka, "and cover them with some nettles, and you might at least ask for some milk for me."
But when he had drunk some milk and appeased his hunger thus, he felt ashamed of having shown his annoyance to a stranger, and he began to laugh at his hungry hostility. In the evening they went shooting again, and Veslovsky had several successful shots, and at night they drove home. Their homeward journey was as lively as their drive out had been. Veslovsky sang songs and related with enjoyment his adventures with the peasants, who had regaled him with vodka and said to him, "No offence meant," and his night's adventures, the games, and the servant girl, and the peasant who had asked him was he married, and on learning that he wasn't, said to him, "Well, mind you don't run after other men's wives. You'd better get one of your own." These words had particularly amused Veslovsky.
"Altogether, I've enjoyed our outing very much. And you, Levin?"
"I have, very much,"
Levin said quite sincerely. It was particularly delightful to him to have got rid of the hostility he had been feeling toward Vasyenka Veslovsky at home, and to feel instead the most friendly disposition toward him. Chapter 14. The next morning, at 10 o'clock, Levin, who had already made the rounds of the estate, knocked at the room where Vasyenka had been put for the night.
"Entrez!" Veslovsky called to him. "Excuse me, I've only just finished my ablutions," he said, smiling, standing before him in his underclothes only. "Don't mind me, please."
Levin sat down on the windowsill.
"Have you slept well?" "Like the dead. What sort of a day is it for shooting?" "What will you take, tea or coffee?" "Neither. I'll wait till lunch. I'm really ashamed. I suppose the ladies are up. A walk now would be nice."
"Show me your horses."
After walking about the garden, visiting the stable, and even doing some gymnastic exercises together on the parallel bars, Levin returned to the house with his guest, and went with him to the drawing-room.
"We had splendid shooting and so many delightful experiences," said Veslovsky, going up to Kitty, who was sitting at the samovar. "What a pity ladies are cut off from these delights."
"Well, I suppose he must say something to the lady of the house," Levin said to himself.
Again it seemed to him that there was something in the smile, in the all-conquering air with which their guest addressed Kitty. The princess, sitting on the other side of the table with Marya Vlasyevna and Stepan Arkadyevitch, called Levin to her side and began to talk to him about moving to Moscow for Kitty's confinement and getting rooms ready for them. Just as Levin had disliked all the trivial preparations for his wedding as detracting from the grandeur of the event, now he felt still more offensive the preparations for the approaching birth, the date of which they decided, it seemed, on their fingers. For a long time he tried to turn a deaf ear to these discussions on the best methods of swaddling the new baby, tried to turn away and avoid seeing the mysterious endless strips of knitting, the triangular pieces of linen, and so on, to which Dolly attached special importance. The birth of a son, he was certain it would be a son, which was promised him, but which he still couldn't believe in, so marvellous did it seem, presented itself to his mind on one hand as a happiness so immense and therefore so incredible, on the other as an event so mysterious that this assumption of a definite knowledge of what would be, and in consequent preparation for it, as for something ordinary that did happen to people, seemed shocking and degrading to him. But the princess didn't understand his feelings, and put down his reluctance to think and talk about it to carelessness and indifference, and so she gave him no peace. She had commissioned Stepan Arkadyevitch to look for an apartment, and now she called Levin to her.
"I know nothing about it, princess. Do as you think fit," he said.
"You must decide when you will move."
"I really don't know."
"I know millions of children are born away from Moscow, and doctors."
"Why?"
"But if so..." "Oh, no, as Kitty wishes." "We can't talk to Kitty about it. Do you want me to frighten her?" "Why, this spring Natalia Golitsyna died from having an ignorant doctor."
"I will do just what you say," he said gloomily.
The princess began talking to him, but he didn't hear her. Though the conversation with the princess had indeed disturbed him, he was gloomy, not on account of that conversation, but from what he saw at the samovar.
"No, it's impossible," he thought, glancing now and then at Vasenka, bending over Kitty, telling her something with his charming smile, and at her, flushed and agitated. There was something indecent in Vasenka's attitude, in his eyes, in his smile. Levin even saw something indecent in Kitty's attitude and look. And again the light died away in his eyes. Again, as before, all of a sudden, without the slightest transition, he felt cast down from a pinnacle of happiness, peace, and dignity into an abyss of despair, rage, and humiliation. Again, everything and everyone had become hateful to him.
"You do just as you think best, princess," he said again, looking around. "Oh, heavy art thou, cap of Monomach," Stepan Arkadyevitch said, playfully hinting, evidently not simply at the princess's conversation, but at the cause of Levin's agitation, which he had noticed. "How late you are today, Dolly."
Everyone got up to meet Darya Alexandrovna. Vasenka rose only for an instant, and with the lack of courtesy to ladies characteristic of a modern young man, he scarcely bowed and resumed his conversation again, laughing at something.
"I've been worn out by Masha. She didn't sleep well, and is dreadfully petulant this morning," said Dolly.
The conversation Vasenka had started with Kitty was running on the same lines as on the previous evening, discussing Anna, and whether love is to be put higher than worldly considerations. Kitty disliked the conversation, and she was disturbed both by the subject and the tone in which it was conducted, and also by the knowledge of the effect it would have on her husband. But she was too simple and innocent to know how to cut short this conversation, or even to conceal the superficial pleasure afforded her by the young man's very obvious admiration. She wanted to stop it, but she didn't know what to do. Whatever she did, she knew would be observed by her husband, and the worst interpretation put on it. And in fact, when she asked Dolly what was wrong with Masha, and Vasenka, waiting till this uninteresting conversation was over, began to gaze indifferently at Dolly, the question struck Levin as an unnatural and disgusting piece of hypocrisy.
"What do you say? Shall we go and look for mushrooms today?" said Dolly.
"By all means, please, and I shall come too," said Kitty, and she blushed. She wanted from politeness to ask Vasenka whether he would come, and she didn't ask him.
"Where are you going, Kostya?" she asked her husband with a guilty face as he passed by her with a resolute step. This guilty air confirmed all his suspicions.
"The mechanic came when I was away. I haven't seen him yet," he said, not looking at her.
He went downstairs, but before he had time to leave his study, he heard his wife's familiar footsteps running with reckless speed to him.
"What do you want?"
he said to her shortly.
"We're busy."
"I beg your pardon," she said to the German mechanic. "I want a few words with my husband." The German got up to go, but Levin said to him,
"Don't bother." "The train is at 3?
The German asked.
"I mustn't be late."
Levin, not answering him, walked out with his wife.
"Well, what have you to say to me?"
he said to her in French. He didn't look her in the face, for he had no wish to see that she was trembling all over and had a piteous, crushed look.
I want to say that we can't go on like this, that this is misery," she said.
"The servants are there in the pantry," he said angrily. "Don't make a scene."
"Well, let's go in here."
They were standing in the passage. Kitty would have gone into the next room, but the English governess was giving Tanya a lesson there.
"Well, come into the garden."
In the garden they came upon a peasant weeding the path. And no longer considering that the peasant could see her tear-stained and his agitated face, that they looked like people fleeing from some disaster, they went on with rapid steps, feeling that they must talk out and clear up misunderstandings, must be alone together, and so get rid of the misery they were both feeling.
"We can't go on like this. It's misery. I'm wretched and you're wretched. What for?" she said,
when they at last reached a secluded garden seat at a turn in the lime-tree avenue.
"But tell me one thing. Wasn't there in his tone something improper, indecent, horribly humiliating?" he said, standing before her again in the same position, with his fists pressing his chest, as he had stood before her that night.
"Yes," she said in a shaking voice. "But, Kostya, surely you see I'm not to blame. All morning I've been trying to adopt a tone. But such people! Why did he come? How happy we were," she said, breathless with the sobs that shook her.
Although nothing had been pursuing them, and there was nothing to run away from, and they couldn't possibly have found anything very delightful on that garden seat, the gardener saw with astonishment that they passed him on their way home with comforted and radiant faces. Chapter 15. After escorting his wife upstairs, Levin went to Dolly's part of the house. Darya Alexandrovna, for her part, was in great distress too that day. She was walking about the room, talking angrily to a little girl who stood in the corner, howling. "And you shall stand all day in the corner and have your dinner all alone, and not see one of your dolls, and I won't make you a new frock," she said, not knowing how to punish her. "Oh, she's a disgusting child." She turned to Levin. "Where does she get such wicked propensities?"
"Why, what has she done?"
Levin said, without much interest, for he had wanted to ask her advice, and so was annoyed that he had come at an unlucky moment.
Grisha and she went into the raspberries, and there... I can't tell you what she did. It's a thousand pities Miss Elliot's not with us. This one notices nothing. She's an automaton.
Figurez-vous que la petite...
And Daria Alexandrovna described Masha's crime.
That proves nothing. It's not a question of evil propensities at all. It's simply mischief,
Levin assured her.
But you're upset about something. What have you come for? Asked Dolly. What's going on there?
And in the tone of her question, Levin heard that it would be easy for him to say what he had meant to say. I've not been in there. I've been alone in the garden with Kitty.
We've had a quarrel for the second time since... Stiva came.
Dolly looked at him with her shrewd, comprehending eyes.
Come, tell me, honestly, has there been, oh, not in Kitty, but in that gentleman's behaviour, a tone which might be unpleasant, no, not unpleasant, but horrible, offensive to a husband?
You mean, oh, how shall I say? Stay in the corner, she said to Masha, who, detecting a faint smile on her mother's face, had been turning around. The opinion of the world would be that he is behaving as young men do behave.
Il fait la cour à une jeune et jolie femme.
And a husband who is a man of the world should only be flattered by it.
Yes, yes, said Levin gloomily. But you noticed it.
Not only I, but Stiva noticed it.
Just after breakfast, he said to me in so many words,
Je crois que Veslovsky fait un petit brin de cour à Kitty.
Well, that's all right, then. Now I'm satisfied. I'll tell him to leave, said Levin.
What do you mean? Are you crazy? Dolly cried in horror.
Nonsense, Kostya. Only think, she said, laughing. You can go now to Fanny, she said to Masha.
No, if you wish it, I'll speak to Stiva. He'll take him away. He can say you're expecting visitors. I don't think he fits into the house anyway.
No, no. I'll do it myself.
But you'll quarrel with him.
Not at all. I'll enjoy it, Levin said, his eyes flashing with real enjoyment. Come, forgive her, Dolly. She won't do it again, he said of the little sinner, who hadn't gone to Fanny, but was standing irresolutely before her mother, waiting, and looking up from under her brows to catch her mother's eye.
The mother glanced at her. The child broke into sobs, hid her face on her mother's lap, and Dolly laid her thin, tender hand on her head. And what is there in common between us and him, thought Levin, and he went off to look for Veslovsky. As he passed through the passage, he gave orders for the carriage to be made ready for the drive to the station.
The spring was broken yesterday, said the footman. Well, the covered trap, then, and hurry up.
Where's the visitor?
The gentleman's gone to his room.
Levin came upon Veslovsky at the moment when the latter, having unpacked his things from his trunk and laid out some new songs, was trying on leather gaiters to get ready to go riding. Whether there was something exceptional in Levin's face, or that Vasenka was himself conscious that ce petit brin de cour he was making was out of place in this family, he was somewhat, as much as a young man in society can be, disconcerted at Levin's entrance.
You ride in gaiters?
Yes, it's much cleaner, said Vasenka,
putting his fat leg on a chair, fastening the bottom hook, and smiling with simple-hearted good humour. He was undoubtedly a good-natured fellow, and Levin felt sorry for him, and ashamed of himself as his host, when he saw the shy look on Vasenka's face. On the table lay a piece of stick which they had broken together that morning, trying their strength. Levin took the fragment in his hands and began smashing it up, breaking bits off the stick, not knowing how to begin.
I wanted...
He paused, but suddenly remembering Kitty and everything that had happened, he said, looking him resolutely in the face,
I've ordered the carriage for you.
How so? Vasenka began in surprise. To drive where?
For you to drive to the station,
Levin said gloomily.
Are you going away, or has something happened? It happens that I expect visitors, said Levin, his strong fingers more and more rapidly breaking off the ends of the split stick.
and I'm not expecting visitors, and nothing has happened, but I beg you to go away. You can explain my rudeness as you like.
Vasenka drew himself up.
I beg you to explain, he said, with dignity, understanding at last.
I can't explain, Levin said softly and deliberately, trying to control the trembling of his jaw.
And you'd better not ask.
And as the split ends were all broken off, Levin clutched the thick ends in his fingers, broke the stick in two, and carefully caught the end as it fell. Probably the sight of those tense arms, of the muscles he had proved that morning at gymnastics, of the glittering eyes, the soft voice, and the quivering jaw, convinced Vasenka better than any words. He bowed, shrugging his shoulders and smiling contemptuously.
Can I not see Oblonsky?
The shrug and the smile didn't irritate Levin.
What else was there for him to do? He thought. I'll send him to you at once.
What madness is this? Stepan Arkadyevitch said, when after hearing from his friend that he was being turned out of the house, he found Levin in the garden, where he was walking about, waiting for his guest's departure.
Mais c'est ridicule! What fly has stung you? Mais c'est du dernier ridicule!
What did you think if a young man...
But the place where Levin had been stung was evidently still sore, for he turned pale again when Stepan Arkadyevitch began to enlarge on his argument, and he cut him short.
Please don't go into it. I can't help it. I feel ashamed of how I'm treating you and him. But it won't, I imagine, grieve him greatly to go, and his presence was distasteful to me and to my wife.
But it's insulting to him. Et plus c'est ridicule.
And to me it's both insulting and distressing, and I'm not to blame in any way, so there's no need for me to suffer.
Well, this I didn't expect of you. On peut être jaloux, mais à ce point, c'est du dernier ridicule.
Levin turned quickly and walked away from him to the far end of the avenue, and he went on walking up and down alone. Soon he heard the rumble of the trap, and from behind the trees he could see Vasenka sitting in the hay, unluckily there was no seat in the trap, in his Scotch cap, being driven along the avenue, jolting up and down over the ruts.
What's this? Levin thought, when a footman ran out of the house and stopped the trap. It was the mechanic whom Levin had totally forgotten. The mechanic, bowing low, said something to Veslovsky, then clambered into the trap, and they drove off together.
Stepan Arkadyevitch and the princess were much upset by Levin's action, and he himself felt not only in the highest degree ridicule, but also utterly guilty and disgraced. But remembering what misery he and his wife had been through, when he asked himself how he would act another time, he answered that he would do the same again.
In spite of all this, toward the end of that day, everyone, except the princess, who couldn't pardon Levin's action, became extraordinarily lively and good-humoured, like children after a punishment, or grown-ups after a dreary, ceremonious reception, so that by evening Vasenka's dismissal was spoken of, in the absence of the princess, as though it was some remote event. And Dolly, who had inherited her father's gift of humorous storytelling, made Varenka helpless with laughter as she related for the third and fourth time, always, with fresh, humorous additions, how she had only just put on her new bows for the benefit of the visitor, when, on going into the drawing-room, she suddenly heard the rumble of the wagon. And who should be in the wagon but Vasenka himself, with his Scotch cap, and his songs, and his gaiters and all, sitting in the hay?
If only you'd ordered out the carriage! But no! And then I hear, stop! Oh, I thought, they've relented. I look out, and there I see a fat German sit down beside him, and they drive off together. And my new bows were all for nothing.